Imagine you're riding a night bus,
Right.
just going in endless, exhausting circles through Scottish winter, just to get a few hours of sleep in a hard plastic seat.
Sounds awful.
Yeah, and you're doing this because a government computer system insists you have a safe home to go to.
Yeah.
But the terrifying reality is that returning to that home means facing down a gang armed with knives and a hammer.
Wow. Yeah, that's heavy.
It really is. Today's Wednesday, September 2nd, 2026, and we're looking at how the invisible architecture of your life, your fundamental human rights, how they can just utterly collapse.
Because that invisible architecture is, well, it's something we rarely notice until we fall right through the floorboards. We
Exactly.
navigate our days operating on this unwritten assumption that a safety net exists. You know, that basic human dignities are hardwired into the laws of modern society.
Right. But the sources we are unpacking today, they really revealed the mechanical failures within those
Yeah,
systems.
absolutely do.
So to understand those failures, we are doing a deep dive into a profoundly revealing campaign booklet. It's called Stories of Hope.
Yeah, from the Rights Here, Rights Now campaign.
Right, which is produced by Just Right Scotland and the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. And it's funded by the Independent Human Rights Fund for Scotland and the CORE Foundation.
And I think the entire mission of this document is crucial to point out. It's trying to build the case for stronger codified protections, specifically, you know, paving the way for a human rights bill for Scotland.
Yes, and they do this by presenting six distinct lived experiences.
And treating these lived experiences as data points is really the best way to approach this. I mean, we aren't simply recounting sad anecdotes today.
No, definitely not.
We are reverse engineering six specific Scottish case studies. We're looking at everything from rural classrooms in the Highlands to the immigration bureaucracies in Glasgow.
Just to understand the hidden gears of the state, basically.
Exactly. We need to look at how progressive legislation is drafted, how it's actually implemented, and how the friction between those two things dictates the reality of your rights.
Okay, let's unpack this. I want to start by examining the concept of systemic rigidity. Because, you know, we tend to assume that if a government passes a progressive law, well, the problem is solved.
Right, the right is protected.
Right. But Jamie's story, the young guy sleeping on the night bus, as we just talked about, that proves that a progressive law is totally useless if the administrative machinery underneath it is just too rigid to compute human trauma.
It's a catastrophic failure of bureaucratic translation, really.
Yeah.
So Jamie is a 20-year-old from Northeast Scotland, and he grew up in residential care. After a severe escalation with a former friend, he was targeted by a violent gang.
Armed with a hammer, right?
Yeah, a hammer and knife. So he genuinely and very reasonably feared for his life, which forced him to flee his home area entirely.
And to put this into legal context for you listening, Scotland actually introduced highly progressive housing legislation back in 2025.
Right. It was explicitly designed to enshrine the fundamental right to adequate housing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So on paper, Jamie has a legal right to be sheltered. He literally went to three different local councils
Yeah.
to present as homeless. Yet the mechanism of the bureaucracy just flat out rejected him.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this thinking, how on earth does a council legally refuse a young, care-experienced man fleeing armed violence?
Well, they refuse him because bureaucracies operate on algorithms of criteria, not empathy.
Right.
In JMES' case, the system was snagged on a single data point. He already held a tenancy in his home area.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The local council's protocols dictate that if you have a tenancy on paper, you cannot be classified as homeless, so they therefore have no statutory duty to house you.
Even if going to that tenancy means he might be killed.
Exactly. The system is just structurally incapable of weighing the nuance that accessing that tenancy puts his life in immediate danger.
That is a complete disconnect between the intent of the 2025 law and the reality of the intake forms. I mean, he's bouncing between five different council areas, completely unhoused,
Yeah.
just because the local databases are siloed and rigid.
And it wasn't until he reached Glasgow in early 2026 that a key worker from Shelter Scotland finally intervened.
Yeah, and what's crucial here is that Shelter didn't magically create new laws.
No, they
They
didn't.
simply understood how to force the existing bureaucracy to acknowledge Jamie's reality. They knew how to actually activate his rights.
And that distinction between holding a right on paper and having that right activated by the state, that is the core issue here.
Yeah.
And it doesn't just happen to underprivileged young men fleeing violence, you know? The assumption from the state that you are just fine can be just as damaging as a rigid set of rules.
Right.
We see this mechanical failure perfectly mirrored in the healthcare system through our second case study, Gavin.
Gavin's experience in Edinburgh is fascinating to me because he had every demographic advantage that Jamie totally lacked. In early 2021, Gavin was 26, gainfully employed, living in a nice new flat, and he had a really strong support network.
Right.
Then he noticed this visual distortion. He said it was like a spider's web in the corner of his eye.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah. And over several months, his sight degraded to the point where he described it as looking through tracing paper.
And the clinical side of the system actually eventually worked, albeit pretty slowly.
Yeah.
On his fourth eye test, they identified discoloration on his optic nerve. And that led to a diagnosis of Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, or LHON.
Which is really serious.
Extremely. It is an incurable genetic condition that causes profound and permanent sight loss.
Receiving that diagnosis has to be a massive life-altering event.
Mm-hmm.
But the systemic failure we were analyzing wasn't medical, right? It was administrative silence.
Yes.
The healthcare professionals gave him the clinical diagnosis, but they completely failed to connect him to the social architecture designed to support disabled individuals.
Yeah, it's wild because he was young, articulate, employed, and, you know, he had his girlfriend with him at the appointments. The administrative assumption was just that he would figure it out.
What's fascinating here is how the state creates these massive, well-funded support structures for disability, but hides them behind a door that the patient doesn't even know exists.
Exactly. Nobody told Gavin to register as blind.
No one.
Nobody. Nobody handed him a basic list of sight loss charities or vision rehabilitation services.
It's like buying a top-of-the-line parachute, but the manufacturer just purposely leaves out the instruction manual on how to pull the cord.
That's a great way to put it.
You possess the safety device, but you're still in free fall. I mean, why is it that the burden of discovering these rights falls entirely on the individual, precisely at the moment they are most traumatized or overwhelmed?
What's fascinating here is that it happens because our systems are fundamentally reactive, not proactive. Mm-hmm. They're designed to process inputs, you know, not to actually guide citizens through a holistic journey.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Gavin only managed to unlock his legal entitlements as a disabled person when a charity later informed him that he needed to actively register as blind.
Wow.
And that realization of how fragile the information gap is, well, it pushed Gavin into advocacy. He now campaigns with Vision Collaborative Scotland, arguing that vision rehabilitation shouldn't be a secret you just stumble upon.
Right.
It must be an automatic, joined-up right for anyone facing sight loss.
So that structural failure to communicate a right is one thing. But Gavin's situation makes me think about what happens when the state doesn't just forget to tell you about your rights, but actively begins to dismantle them.
Yeah, the rollback.
Because we assume rights are permanent fixtures, right? But the source material forces us to look at how political tides can quietly erode the foundation right beneath you.
The vulnerability of a political promise is a major, major theme in these sources. And to examine the mechanics of how rights are rolled back, we have to look at another Gavin from the campaign booklet.
Right, Gavin Dare.
Yeah, Gavin Dare. His interaction with the state is absolute and lifelong. Due to his physical disabilities, he literally cannot travel on a bus independently. He requires assistance just to cut his food, and he relies entirely on state support for basic daily living.
And his story requires us to look at the historical timeline of welfare policy in the UK.
It does.
Back in 1980, under Margaret Thatcher's government, a specific policy commitment was made regarding lifelong disabilities. It was essentially this social contract, right?
Yeah, a promise of guaranteed continuous financial support for individuals whose conditions would simply never improve.
Right, but the sources highlight how that social contract was basically torn up in 2013 by the coalition government.
Now, as we analyze Gavin Dare's lived experience here, I want to be extremely clear to you listening. We are neutrally reporting the contents of the rights here.
Right.
Rights Now booklet.
Definitely.
We're simply examining Gavin Nesser's personal fears and his account of policy shifts without endorsing any specific political party or viewpoint. The structural shift that Gavin highlights from 2013 was the introduction of mandatory two-yearly reassessments.
And the mechanism of that reassessment is what's so damaging.
Yes.
The state is essentially shifting the burden of proof entirely onto the citizen. Instead of the government honoring a baseline of dignity for a static lifelong condition, Gavin is forced every 24 months to legally and medically reprove that he is still disabled.
Yeah, he lives in a state of permanent administrative probation.
Exactly. And he directly connects this policy shift to broader media narratives. He points out how public discourse often forces disabled individuals into this impossible binary.
Yeah, the superstar Paralympian or the layabout.
You're either celebrated as an athlete or you're stigmatized as someone draining the system. There's just very little cultural space afforded for someone who simply requires quiet, consistent, lifelong support.
Which totally dismantles the justification we often hear for these grueling assessments. I mean, Gavin highlights a stark statistical reality in the sources.
Yeah, the fraud numbers.
Right. Despite the intense political rhetoric surrounding welfare abuse, the actual rate of benefit fraud is less than 4%.
Less than 4%.
Yeah. Yet the state spends vast resources and inflicts massive psychological stress policing the 96% who are legitimately claiming their rights.
It's unbelievable.
And he openly worries in the text about future governments. He references parties like Reform or others, potentially introducing even tighter, more draconian welfare constraints.
So Gavin Dayer's case illustrates how rights can be slowly eroded by shifting the administrative burden. But if we want to see how the law can be entirely weaponized to just erase a person's rights, we have to look at Marianne's case.
Yeah, Marianne's story is intense.
This is where the mechanisms of the state are hijacked by a malicious actor. It is a masterclass in how abusers exploit legal loopholes.
It really is.
Marianne was a highly qualified young medical doctor from Africa. In 2018, she married a British national from a similar cultural background, and they moved to Glasgow in 2019.
And the abuse began almost immediately upon arrival. But, you know, it wasn't just physical violence. It was structural isolation.
Right. The abuser utilized her status as a newcomer, as a literal instrument of control.
Yeah.
When she attempted to book an online English tutor just to integrate and further her medical career, he used physical violence to stop her.
And he fed her disinformation, too.
Oh, yeah. About the police.
Exactly. He fed her lies about how the Scottish police would treat her, creating this massive psychological barrier between her and the state's protection.
And the ultimate escalation wasn't an assault in their home. It was an exploitation of international borders.
Yes.
Under the guise of a family visit, he traveled with her back to her home country in Africa. Once there, he abandoned her.
He just left.
He flew back to the UK alone, stole her UK residency card, hacked into her personal emails to cut off her communications, and utilized corrupt legal networks in her home country to initiate divorce proceedings without her even being present.
He essentially used the UK Home Office and international borders as the final lock on her cage.
Yeah, because her legal status in the UK was tied to her spousal visa.
Right. So abandoning her without documentation meant the British border forces would just automatically block her return. The abuser didn't even have to enforce her exile himself.
He tricked the state into doing it for him.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? Because initially, looking at this, someone might argue that this is just a horrific, isolated criminal matter. You know, a terrible domestic abuse case.
Right.
How do human rights lawyers actually untangle a transnational abandonment case like this, where the state itself is technically just following its own border rules?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's a profound human rights issue, precisely because the state as blind spots create complicity.
Wow. Complicity.
Yeah. Mariam's fundamental rights to a private life, to education, and to freedom from degrading treatment were annihilated through administrative loopholes.
That's terrifying.
Untangling this required a staff member at a Glasgow college to flag her disappearance. That eventually connected Mariam with human rights lawyers at Just Right Scotland.
And they couldn't just call the police, right? They had to fight this highly technical legal battle.
Precisely. The lawyers had to utilize very specific, hard-won precedents within the UK. Immigration rules designed for survivors of transnational marriage abandonment.
Which is such a specific legal mechanism.
It is. They had to legally prove to the Home Office that Mariam's absence was a result of coercive control, not just a voluntary departure.
Right.
Mariam notes in the text that this is a systemic model of abuse. Networks of men deliberately bring women to the UK under false pretenses of marriage, use them for domestic servitude, and then discard them across borders when they demand their rights.
That is just evil.
It is. And fighting this requires specialized legal mechanics to force the state to recognize the abuse of its own immigration architecture.
That vulnerability of legal status in Mariam's case, it really makes me think about another fundamental boundary line that dictates our rights, physical geography.
Oh, absolutely.
We've seen how rights fail across international borders, but the sources show us that the postcode lottery of rights can happen right inside a single country.
Because geography is the physical frontier of human rights implementation. A policy drafted in an urban center rarely survives contact with rural reality.
Yeah.
And this brings us to Derek Roberts, who is an asthmatic secondary school teacher living in the Scottish Highlands.
Derek is on the front lines of the climate crisis, dealing with the increasing frequency of severe wildfires in his rural area. He describes this impossible structural failure happening right in his classroom during a heat wave. He has to choose between keeping the windows closed to block the toxic, aggravating wildfire smoke, meaning the students swelter in dangerous heat, or opening the windows for ventilation and letting in the smoke and carbon dioxide.
And the mechanism of failure here is centralized policymaking. Derek points out that environmental and emergency policies are generally drafted by politicians in Holyrood or even local authorities in Inverness with a totally urban mindset.
Right.
An urban climate policy might assume a resilient power grid and easy access to emergency services. But in the remote highlands, a severe weather event means power outages lasting for days, flooding that cuts off entire towns, and a complete breakdown of centralized support.
The one-size-fits-all approach is actually a one-size-fits-cities approach.
Exactly.
So Derek is actively campaigning with the Environmental Rights Center for Scotland to change the legal mechanics of this. He's demanding that rural communities be legally empowered and funded to draw up localized civil defense-style action plans.
Which makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Just as a school has an automatic funded protocol for a snow day, they need localized legal protocols for heat waves and wildfires. Mm-hmm. And they need to be designed by the people actually breathing the air.
Derek's fight for localized environmental rights provides a really compelling contrast to our final case study, NAS.
Yeah, definitely.
Because if Derek demonstrates how geography dilutes rights within Scotland, NAS demonstrates the terrifying extreme of geographic human rights denial on a global scale.
NAS's story is staggering. She is originally from a deeply rural area in northwest Pakistan near the Afghan border.
Right.
It's a region governed by the incredibly rigid Jirga system, which structurally and violently suppresses women's independence. Back in 2011, Naz became an activist, specifically organizing to defend the rights of female nurses and health workers who were facing targeted violence.
And the patriarchal structure reacted immediately to eliminate the threat she posed. She was physically attacked by men on a motorbike.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But the most insidious mechanism of control came through her own family, yielding to immense community pressure regarding honor.
Right.
Her parents physically imprisoned her in their own home for 4 months. She was entirely isolated, waiting for the corrupt local authorities to formalize her punishment.
4 months. She eventually engineered an escape, though, securing a flight to the Gulf to reunite with her husband, who had also fled.
Right.
But the failure of global protection systems became apparent instantly. Within 1 hour of her landing in the Gulf, her phone rang. The networks tracking her knew exactly where she was.
This exposes a massive flaw in the international human rights architecture. The global system of asylum is slow, bureaucratic, and bound by borders.
Yeah.
But the networks of oppression mercenaries, digital trackers, corrupt authorities, they operate globally and instantaneously.
They spent 4 years on the run through multiple countries. While seeking safety in Azerbaijan, they were actually abducted by mercenaries posing as the local military.
It sounds like a movie, but it's real life.
It really does. The only reason they weren't disappeared entirely was because they managed to activate a digital location marker that alerted an underground network of international allies.
Wow.
They were relying on literal spycraft to survive because the international asylum laws completely failed to shield them.
They eventually secured safe passage to the UK after multiple asylum rejections elsewhere. Naz is now living in Scotland. She actually accessed a protection program for human rights defenders at risk at Dundee University, and she's pursuing a master's in applied human rights at York University.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. If you put Derek, the Highland teacher, and Naz, the Pakistani activist, side by side, the scale of their danger is obviously completely different.
Sure.
But mechanically, they are fighting the exact same structural flaw, the postcode lottery. It is like installing a state-of-the-art smoke alarm in the living room, but hardwiring it to ignore a blazing fire in the kitchen. If a human right cannot reach into a rural Highland classroom or penetrate the borders of a rural Pakistani province, then that right fundamentally isn't universal. It is strictly conditional on where you are standing.
This raises an important question regarding the architecture of power itself. who holds the pen when these protections are designed?
Yeah, who decides?
Exactly. Whether we're analyzing the well-meaning but disconnected politicians in Holyrood drafting climate policy, or the oppressive patriarchal jirga system in Pakistan enforcing isolation, the vulnerable are completely locked out of the design phase.
Yeah.
When the center of power is culturally or geographically insulated from the periphery, the mechanisms of human rights will always fail the people who need them most.
Which brings all six of these data points from the Rights Here, Rights Now campaign into sharp focus. They are the warning lights on the dashboard of our society.
Absolutely.
Whether it's Jamie fighting an algorithm for housing, Gavin needing a simple administrative pathway for his sight loss, Gavin Dayer pushing back against relentless welfare assessments, Miriam untangling immigration loopholes, Derek fighting for clean air, or Nas outrunning global mercenaries. Human rights are not static objects. They require incredibly exhausting daily maintenance.
And we must recognize the mechanics doing that maintenance. The source material highlights the vital structural role of partner organizations.
Right.
Glasgow Disability Alliance, the Environmental Rights Center for Scotland, Shelter Scotland, Just Right Scotland, Vision Collaborative Scotland, and academic sanctuaries like the University of Dundee. They are the ones actually forcing the rigid bureaucracies to flex and accommodate human reality.
Because without that knowledge, you are defenseless. I keep returning to a vital realization from Miriam in the campaign booklet. She stated, "I am highly educated, and even I did not realize that my fundamental human rights were being denied."
That's a powerful quote.
It is. Understanding the mechanisms of these laws is the mandatory first step. You cannot fix the invisible architecture of your life or recognize when it's being weaponized against you if you don't even know it's there.
Which leaves us with a paradox to consider. We've spent this time looking at how rights require endless defense and immense personal bravery. But crucially, the burden of that defense almost always falls entirely on the individual, precisely when they are at their most vulnerable.
Yeah, that's so true.
Jamie, Gavin, Nas, they had to become activists and legal scholars just to survive the systems designed to protect them. So if a human right can be lost through a simple bureaucratic oversight, a siloed computer system, or geographic bad luck, are they truly rights at all?
Wow.
Or are they simply privileges that the exhausted and the vulnerable are forced to continually rent with their own trauma?
That is a staggering thought. It completely changes the way you view the safety net. Are we walking on a solid floor of legal guarantees, or are we just hoping the administrative machinery holds up for one more day? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the invisible architecture around you, and we will catch you next time.